Well, I got my call from my draft board today. In one more week, I'm on my way. Well, 2 years might not be so long, but I got to leave my baby at home. He's gonna rock my baby when I'm gone.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. James, we're taking over the station. We're with my friend James James Porter. I've known you forever. You're a writer. You're a DJ. You got a book coming out.
Indeed.
I see you. You got a great radio voice. I see you at all these shows and stuff. So, you know, when said you're doing this 11 to 1 shift, I said, who can come in at 12:30 on a Thursday night? It's James Porter.
So I'm glad that you thought of me. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming down.
Sure.
So, I know you're a Berenice Whitfield fan, and we're going to talk about your book that's coming out next year. But tell the listeners, like, just a little about your roots, where you grew up, and how music came into your life.
Okay. Who is James Porter? Okay. James Porter grew up in the Chatham area on the south side of Chicago, and I got into music really early. And I think ever since college, I've kind of worn like three hats. I've been a DJ. I'm still a DJ, and I'm a writer, and I've been a musician playing in different bands here and there. And I've kind of like combined all of that. I mean, I've had I've kind of had a love for roots music. I mean, I've written about a whole bunch of different things, a whole bunch of different kinds of music, but I've always had like that thing for where it came from, you know, and whoever's out now, I think of who came before, because I mean, nothing's totally new under the sun. I keep thinking that, you know, you can trace everything back some way, you know.
It's kind of like what we do. It's almost like journalism with anthropology. You kind of look,
you know,
back. Yeah, right. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And that's really, it's fun as a writer. It's also fun for the reader.
Right.
Yeah. So talk about, was there music around the house? What was your exposure to music as a kid?
Oh, Lord. My father was a big blues and country fan. He came from Flora, Mississippi, and he brought his music up with him. And my mother, she listened to a lot of soul and gospel. She'd be driving me to school, and we would listen to WVON on the car all the way down. And those things kind of shaped my tastes. And there have been a lot of things I've liked over the years that, you know, didn't come from those, because I cannot see my father, born in 1931, listening to the New York Dolls. But I love them, you know. And so, I mean, I've just kind of like, you know, I mean, my music tastes are pretty, at this point, it's all over the place, I would say.
Where'd you go to high school? And I know you went to Loyola, but pre-Loyola, what was that like?
Pre-Loyola, that was like Academy of St. James. That was during the era where I was in high school in the early 80s. That's when the house music thing was coming up. And even though I wasn't, to this day, I've never been really a house head. You know, there's like still certain songs I remember from that time, because, like I say, they're always playing in the background on somebody else's radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think like things like Love Sensation by Lolita Holloway.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's that one song by Loose Joints? Is It All Over My Face? Like I said, that's not the music that I listen. That's not the music that I bought when I went down to JR's Music Shop in Evergreen Plaza. But I heard it all the same. And so I do kind of feel like, you know, it was the background. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then you go to Loyola.
Mm hmm. There you go.
What do you study?
The lucrative field of journalism, communications. Yes. So yes, and I did a few things. I mean, I got started in journalism. Really, believe it or not, I read. I was so much into music that I read Goldmine magazine.
Oh, of course.
As a teenager, you know, and I mean that wasn't a typical, like, you know, Rolling Stone type magazine. I mean, that was pretty esoteric. You know, especially for, like, you know, 16-year-old black kid to be into. And I was also a big Cheech and Chong fan. And the first article I ever did that got printed was a retrospective of Cheech and Chong for Goldmine magazine. I don't know who's going to go to Harold Washington Library and dig that up, but it exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a skeleton of my closet. Well, I still think they're funny. But I started writing more about music as I got older, particularly for Loyola. And, of course, you know, as I got older, I wrote for New City for a number of years, you know, and in addition to contributing and being a staff member of other magazines, of course, I was also one of the first staff members of Time Out Chicago when they first came to Chicago for the first few years they were around. So I've spent a lot of time trying to turn over rocks and expose people to things that are out there they might have overlooked.
How is that? changed. I mean, I think we traveled maybe a parallel path with that. I mean, back in the day, I know you did stuff like on Swamp Dog, and when you want to pitch a story with editors and stuff, is there still an appreciation for a sense of the unknown and a sense of discovery, or have things gotten more commercial?
I think there sort of is, because I mean, if I were to, you know, write, I mean, anybody can pitch a story on, say, Chance the Rapper because he's hotter than a pistol.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's the first thing on everybody's mind. But it's one thing to write pitch a story on, like, you know, somebody on his opening act. You know, somebody who's on an indie label who might not become a star, but, you know, it's kind of like a star in their own stream, like, say, a Barrence Whitfield, who's been out there for years recording for indie labels and whatnot. But, I mean, he still has a very devoted following, you know, especially in Chicago, especially now that he records for a Chicago label, Bloodshot. And yeah. So I'm all about those parallel streams.
You know, I mean, what happened to me at the same time, I think, toward the end with feature writing, was it got to be clickbait, you know, and I would tell the story.
Oh, wow.
We're friends with the Waco brothers. And,
yes.
And I was one of the first to write about them. I saw them at Wrigleyville Tap, and it was just, you know, there were like 30 people, 20 people in the room. It was just a goofy show. And I had to write about it. I had to share it with the readers. I was so excited, you know. And I think toward the end of my career at the Sun-Times, you know, I would have really had to justify doing a story like that, because where's the clickbait? Somebody would say, who knows these people? Who are the Waco brothers? When back in the day, when like McLeese and I were there, there was more of a sense of discovery for stuff.
Exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that is exactly what I'm seeing right now. Yeah. You know, and even worse, I'm seeing people who kind of accept that. You know, people who are like, you know, don't wait. I mean, don't discover things yourself. Wait for the PR people to discover for you. And nothing against my PR, nothing against my PR friends, but it's just nice to, like I say, it's like, you know, turn over rocks and discover for yourself. I mean, yes, I mean, whoever's got the most hits online, you know, it's great that, you know, it's great that they should be acknowledged, but there's some people in the subways of Chicago, you know, who have an interesting story that should be told,
right,
regardless of whether they make a chart or not. So, you know, and that's where I'm coming from.
And you also, another reason I'm a fan of yours is you also don't have any musical barriers. Like the bubblegum music is the naked truth. You wouldn't expect a black guy to be writing about that, right?
I feel very, very... I love the fact that that's pretty much the parameters of my musical taste right there. Yeah. From Robert Johnson to the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. Yeah. That's heaven to me.
Yeah.
So, you know...
How did that happen? I mean, where'd your love of like bubblegum music come?
Well, child of the 70s. What can I say?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, and plus, I mean, child of a father who was into the Delta blues, so I mean, that's the world I'm living in, you know.
Did it have something to do with Chicago radio, rock radio at that time? I mean, I grew up in 60s radio, so of course you heard all kinds of stuff then.
Right.
I don't know how. Maybe by the 70s, I was going more toward FM.
I kind of got that secondhand. There was an automated oldie station that I used to listen to called WFYR at Chicago.
Oh yeah,
Fire.
I remember that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And even though, I mean, they didn't have many DJs. I mean, it would be like, you know, they play a song and all of a sudden you hear a booming voice. And that was John Fred, the Playboy Band with Judy in the Skies.
Yeah.
You know, they run like Dick Clark's syndicated show, and I learned a lot from that. But when I wasn't listening to the Soul Station, listening to like LaBelle and the Ohio Players, the Jackson 5 and whoever, I started listening to the oldie station as a goof, you know, or just to hear like the old Motown stuff that I was too young to get to. But the next thing you know, I'm like, that grassroots song they've been playing is pretty good.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, my musical taste, I mean, in a lot of ways, when people told me that if they didn't know who I was, they'd think I was like a baby boomer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But my taste going in a lot of different directions that you wouldn't expect somebody with my background to go, I guess.
And as I mentioned, you've got a great radio voice, so you do Hoodoo Party.
Well, thank you. Exactly,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about that. That's on WLUW.
That's right. Thank you. The Hoodoo Party has been around since the summer of 2013. And I guess I call it Thinking Man's Oldie Show. I play the best vintage rock and roll, rhythm, blues, and all points in between from like roughly 1950s, 1967.
You're doing your rap there. That's good.
doing all the genre, like, you know, the surf, the rockabilly, the garage, the southern soul, the northern soul, you know, the jump blues, you know, even sidetrack into country and western and gospel, and it all flows together, and most of my audience gets it. They don't ask me, so James, I don't get why you go from question mark and Mysterians to the Five Blind Boys of Alabama. I think most of the listeners that I've talked to kind of get that it's all part of the same thing, at least the same James Porter thing. I don't know. But
yeah.
Yes.
And the one thing I didn't know about you is you do play. You play a little harmonica.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, talk about that.
Okay. I've been playing harmonica ever since I was a teenager. Frustrated guitar player, although I still use the bright songs. But ever since I started going to like blues jams. I mean, I've been playing high school, you know, playing with my friends. Like, oh, wow, you sound just like little Stevie Wonder, you know? And I'd go to, I mean, after I got to college, you know, I started going to like, you know, the jam nights at like Kingston Mines and Wise Fools. We're talking the '80s, and I fell in with a new group of guys, and that kind of opened up a whole new thing for me. And I started playing in bands like not too long after that. I mean, a lot of the bands that I've been, contrary to popular belief, even though I'm identified with the blues, a lot of my bands have sort of been like, you know, kind of like, you know, like rockabilly garage type stuff. I mean, I've been compared to, I mean, that sounds egotistical. I've been compared to, but I mean, I'm gonna take that back, please. But I mean, sort of in, so I guess like a Barrence Whitfield, you know, Mick Collins kind of vein, sort of in that, you know, rockabilly and garage. I mean, those like really my two big loves in rock and roll.
That's who we heard at the beginning of the segment was Barrence Whitfield.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who I first saw at the Cubby Bear back in 1988.
Isn't
killed
something?
It. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and then I want to, now that we've set up who you are, I want to really talk about, I'm really excited about this book,
yeah, hope
Wild in the
long.
Streets, Tales from Rock and Roll Negroes League, Rock and Roll's Negro Leagues.
Yeah.
And that'll be out next year on Northwestern University Press, so don't
Indeed.
Go away, and we're going to talk about that on Nocturnal Journal on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN in Chicago. And in the studio, we have Chicago author, writer, musician James Porter. Thanks for joining us, James.
You got it.
That's some Barrence Whitfield there. And talk about, I'm fascinated about this book, Wild in the Streets, Tales from Rock and Roll's Negro Leagues, out next year by
yes.
Northwestern University Press.
Yes.
Give us the thesis of the book.
Okay. Basically, it's... The concept of black rock and roll is kind of like, you know, I mean, a lot of people don't think of like, you know, when I say black rock and roll, people think it's like a synonym for rhythm and blues. It's really not. It's basically like, you know, black artists working the field of rock and roll. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain. For like the earliest years of rock and roll up until like maybe 1965, rock and R&B were basically synonyms. They were basically the same thing. You know, I mean, Sam Cooke was the same thing as Eddie Cochran. You know, but after 65, after the Beatles, rock became rock and soul became soul, you know, and it was very seldom that you saw, I mean, there were a lot of white guys doing soul, but I mean, you saw the occasional black person in rock, you know, like the Arthur Lees and the Jimi Hendrixes and the Richie Havenses and people like that, you know, and that's always, as a teenage African-American rock fan, that has always intrigued me. I was always, every time I saw a rock band on TV and they had a black guy in the band, even if he's 9 times out of 10, he was always playing the bass and the drums. Always. Never fail. From Three Dog Night to, I mean, all of them, man. The Little Feet, Allman Brothers, that just a thing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, how'd that brother get there? You know, but I loved it even more when they had the black guy up front, like in Thin Lizzy.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I keep hearing these stories about how there were like other black rock bands, you know, who are out there, but you know, the record labels got cold feet because they figured that that wouldn't play in certain areas, you know, or they figured that, you know what, this rock and roll thing is doing pretty good. Why don't you get into more of like a funky fusion kind of thing? They'll get you on R&B stations and they'll cross over, you know. The Isley Brothers were really frustrated about that. Because in their 70s recordings, especially with Ernie Isley, after he started playing guitar, I mean, they were really rock-oriented, and they really, really wanted to get on FM radio, you know, and Stevie Wonder crossed that bridge. The War crossed that bridge, but the Isley Brothers couldn't. They had, like, number one albums, you know, top 10 albums, and they were, like, complaining in Rolling Stone in 1978, you know, that how come they don't get the same sales as Boston Fleetwood Mac. And they were even mixed like rock records. I mean, they knew who they were aiming at, but it didn't work. And that has kind of like, you know, intrigued me. You know, I mean, I played in rock and roll bands, and seeing that I play the harmonica, there are a lot of people like, my band could do a set somewhere, and people come up to me and they're like, that was some really great down home blues. And I'm like, we didn't do a 12 bar song all night long. We were more into a rockabilly vein. I guess they were listening with their ears, with their eyes instead of their ears. But
yeah, right.
I mean, that those kind of stories, you know, I guess because my story fascinates me a lot. So, you know,
who all's in the book? I mean, what's your source material? Who all did you interview?
It was basically a bunch of interviews, some of which I'm still transcribing. Barrence Whitfield, Mick Collins, the late great Jimmy Castor.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Leroy, right?
Yeah, him, yeah. He did a couple of like kind of heavy metal, kind of funk LPs in the 70s.
Yeah, that, right.
Yeah, and one of them, which included Troglodyte. Yeah. Who else did I speak to? A whole bunch of things. This a local art rock band called Ono. You know, I mean, it was all over the place. Max Ann, you know, a female led, you know,
is Nikki, I saw
band.
On this list, I don't know, is Nikki Hill part of this, or is she just one of your, we just saw her at Fitzgerald's.
Right, she's a contemporary favorite of mine. She definitely identifies with the rock and roll vibe, and I hope she's out there listening. How you doing, Nikki? Say hi to Matt for me. So, I'm a big fan of hers, you know what I mean? There's a lot of contemporary, you know, African-American rockers I like, too. Like, there's a local band called Urzuli, and there's another band called there's a singer called Eric Sheridan who has the North Avenue Stompers, and it just kind of goes on and on. I mean, these people are in different genres, mind you. I mean, it's not like the typical. I've noticed that there was a period after Living Color was big, and all the companies were like rushing to sign their version of Living Color. And a lot of the lesser bands, I mean, it's almost like they only had like Jimi Hendrix and George Clinton as templates, and that was great. Those are great guys, but it seems like it's kind of like, you know, the direction only black rockers could go. I kind of like the fact that they're like, you know, I mean, in the book you'll find like a black surf guitarist, Willie Glover from the Pyramids. They were one of those beach party movies backing up Stevie Wonder. They were like the five guys with bald head, the world's first skinhead interracial surf band. All five guys with bald heads, and one of them was a brother. That was Willie Glover, the guitar player, and black rockabilly like Ray Sharp. Eddie Clearwater's in the book, too.
Yeah, right, but,
so, I mean, it's kind of like all over the place. A few funk bands who had one foot in rock, and of course, a lot of punk bands, too, like a guy named Leon, who was from the New York punk scene in the 70s.
Boy, this is going to be great. So, your point about how it would have to be reclaimed, even though it is an African-American tradition, you know.
Yes.
It's really fascinating. It'll be out next year.
Yes.
Northwestern University Press,
exactly.
Wild in the Streets, Tales from Rock and Roll's Negro Leagues.
Exactly.
And tell us about all the other stuff. You got anything coming up? You spinning anywhere?
Yes, I do spin at the Delilah's over here on 2771 North Lincoln. I do Garage Night on the last Wednesday of the month, and also, too, on the Hoodoo Party. That's a show that airs on WLUW, the third Saturday every month, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Okay, thank you, James Porter.